Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Barton Bond. He is film and video coordinator in business and professional studies with Santa Fe Community College. And Lenny Sanchez, who is a film crew member. He also teaches at the Santa Fe Community College. And he's a member of the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees. And we're here to talk about New Mexico's burgeoning film industry. Once again, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Good morning.
It's great to have you here. Now, Lenny, you have the particular distinction of having invented the word Tamalewood. What's that all about?
Well, it's just a little slogan I came up with about 2005, and it describes the emerging, the film, all the films that were coming out here. And so I was on a set, actually, a small set out in Taos, and I invented the name, and then it just went like wildfire, actually. So I'm very happy to have – I got the trademark, actually, so I'm very happy about that.
And then this last December, you presented the first Tamalewood Award at the Santa Fe Film Festival, right?
Yes, that's right. We decided to go a little bit large with this because of all the media that it's getting, and so I came up with the Tamalewood Award that I give away and I pay for with my company. At the Santa Fe, at the film festival this year, we gave away the first one, the Borderlands, I believe.
Yes.
And we're going to continue to do this, even though it's a little pricey, but we're going to do it because I think it's well, I think it's well received.
Now, is there any special something that characterizes movies made in New Mexico?
I think so. I think they have a special flavor. I think our crew is down with the system, like the way we roll. It's a very hard place to shoot. Local New Mexicans know how to work in New Mexico, and I think that's, it's not easy, to build out in the middle of nowhere, build these towns that we do. Our carpenters are very, very well, they're very well trained, and I'm a construction guy, so I like to talk up a lot of construction a lot in these films. Yeah.
So you build entire towns. Is it usually for Western movie kind of thing, or...
Exactly. And sometimes we go into a town that's already been built and we have to redo it or retweak it the way we say. And, the weather's bad, the weather's good. We're out there and we're doing this. And I'm very proud of a lot of the carpenters in the local.
Do you find that you're sometimes filming, making films that are set in July and you have to film them in February?
Yeah, there's a time where sometimes we go out and we have to remove snow for the shot because it was supposed to read in the springtime. And, a lot of the things we do, they're not planned. And we go into work and sometimes we have to stay late and sometimes, the rain, the snow and stuff. So some of the things are not planned. They're on the fly.
So there's very much of a creative aspect to the work that you do, even if it's construction and so on. You're sort of turning on a dime.
We're turning on a dime and we're trying to make this thing alive here in New Mexico. And I think the word Tamalewood kind of sums it all up, and I share it with the crew. And actually it blew out for me not going to the press. I thought of the name and I went and did my paperwork, but I never went to the press. I didn't go to the New Mexican or whatever and say, hey, I thought of this word. What happened was is that I shared it with the crew and it just everyone started saying it. And, it's okay if they say it was coined by a local newspaper. Actually, it was coined by me. And it doesn't bother me at all. It would have bothered me if I wouldn't have got the trademark. But I moved on it quick, and I took care of that.
Barton Bond, there's some interesting projects going on in New Mexico these days. One of them is by a young man from the New Mexico School for the Deaf.
Tommy Tischler, who is a New Mexico School for the Deaf graduate, high school graduate, is one of our students in the film crew training program, and he recently received a $5,000 grant from the Governor's Cup to produce a documentary. The Governor's Cup is an aspect of the state of New Mexico, coordinated through the film office, to encourage the production of projects that, just as you and Lenny were talking about, that are New Mexico based. And Tommy is one of my students in the film crew class, And his documentary is going to focus on the football coach at the Mexico School for the Deaf, who is himself deaf, who will be coaching at the sixth man, which is the smallest school, a high school football competition, all-star game in Ruidoso in a couple of weeks. And Tommy's is all over this, and the project is going to be really interesting for a number of perspectives. The fact that this gentleman who is a coach, a deaf football coach, is the first one in the country to do that at a deaf school, and Tommy being a deaf person is going to be making a documentary. So it's just all these really intricate relationships, and process the relationship to our program here, because he's one of our students. We're going to support his production with our equipment, and I have a whole batch of students that are going to go down and shoot with him. And I have a student who's just terrific, who's going to help produce, make the arrangements and all that kind of stuff. So we're very hopeful, and I don't mean to be getting the chicken ahead of the cart or whatever that.
I believe it's the horse.
The horse and the cart, right? The chicken and the egg, but. I think this is going to turn out to be really a nifty project, and it will, if it's anything like we think it's going to be, it'll be shown nationally and probably on some cable channel nationally, because it's just it has all these really wonderful elements.
What kind of challenges does Tommy Tischler face as a deaf student in the film industry?
Well, he came to our class not really wanting to work in the union as Lenny does and his cohorts. He wanted to find out about filmmaking because he intends to make himself to push himself toward being an independent filmmaker. So he's been in the class and his perspective from Charlotte has been to learn what all the different jobs are, and we call it set etiquette, the relationships on the set, who's in charge of what, the progression, how things flow from one item to another. But I must say he's been on every project that we've done and has just done a yeoman's work of working really hard. The first project we shot a couple of weeks ago was three nights down at Galisteo Dam from 4 in the evening till 3 or 4 in the morning. And Lenny was on that doing sound. And Tommy was there the whole time. And his interpreters were there the whole time too, which is really – I shouldn't laugh, but these poor ladies are following him around trying to just to keep up with what's going on. But he's just eating this stuff up. And so I think he's going to become this is just the beginning of his – career. Hopefully he'll stay in New Mexico. I don't see any reason why he would leave. But we think, he and I and his folks think, there's a tremendous market, if you want to think about it that way, for products for the deaf or the hard of hearing, the hearing disabled or whatever that term is, community. Not just this documentary, which will be very interesting, I think, to a lot of people, but things focused on those folks and their just dealing with the world in general.
How much of the market for the films that are made in New Mexico goes to movie theaters versus other venues like television and other stuff?
The story is, Mary Charlotte, that less and less as a percentage of the stuff made in New Mexico and just in general in the movie industry would be what we would call the traditional movie stuff that would show in the walk-in theaters, like it's the Cinema 14 over here. More and more product, it's called, goes to different places, directly to DVD, so it never shows in the theater, directly to foreign markets. Lenny's worked on a couple of those. And it won't be very long before there will be a commercial, a major commercial enterprise with YouTube and MySpace and podcasting and cell phone casting and all those kinds of things.
How would it work on YouTube where you can access the material for nothing?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's kind of funny. A year ago, YouTube didn't exist. About 9 months ago, it was just a little thing. 6 months ago, Google bought it for $1.2 billion. And they have not, to my understanding, Mary Charlotte, Google has not figured out how to make money off of it yet. But they saw it as this huge thing that they had to get in on. So there are all kinds of models now that are being tested, which will be very different from what we normally think of in terms of accessing entertainment. And the fact, part of the YouTube attraction is that anybody can post anything on there at any time.
Which I love.
Yeah, exactly. So somewhere in that, I mean, there's a lot of, as we say, a lot of eyeballs. And Lenny has posted some stuff on MySpace.
That's right.
Lenny's a musician and has been a musician for a long time before he got into the film business. And he's had a lot of hits on that. And his, you know, he should talk about this, but, you know, we've talked about it. He's coming out with another, Lenny's released, how many CDs have you had?
Well, I got one CD I did in 95, and this next one we've been putting it together, so we're going to go with the MySpace idea. And, of course, you know that.
A CD for what? You're a rock star?
Yeah, I'm like a total wannabe rock star. If you ask anyone who knows me, they know that I've been in bands all my life, and I've, you know, I'm the one that I think I created the local music scene back in the 70s. You know, I was always trying to get into clubs, and the Club West was one of my favorite, like, sneak-in clubs before I could even get in. But one of the ideas I see now with this New Mexico film idea is it's so fresh right now. It's wide open, and we all need to get connected because that's where we're going to establish a New Mexico film industry.
We're talking to Lenny Sanchez and Barton Bond.
The process that we know of, for example, just really quickly about Lenny's MySpace thing, is has to do with the fact that in the music domain, and we're going to be heading for this very quickly in the film domain, you don't have to go with a major record label anymore to be successful. So Lenny is going to put some stuff of his original music on MySpace, let people sample it for free, and then indicate to them, hey, if you like this, here's my CD, and this is how to get it. Or to buying a CD now, probably, you know, the hard copy is the way we're going to go. But eventually, somebody will be able to download completely the whole CD, or to pick pieces off, you know, to sample online, and then say, I like, you know, you got 12 cuts on here, I like 7 of them, so I'll pay you $1 a piece for, you know, each one of those, something like that. So that's just one tiny little part of how the world is changing in terms of media applications. And as we've said on this program here, Charlotte, so many times, the model that we use in New Mexico is two-pronged. All the stuff that we're doing with our film crew training program and how Lenny got into this is to attract films, traditional ones, from Hollywood to come here because they have the money. They're always looking for a way to make a product for less money. So New Mexico still leads the nation. We're one of the top three in the nation in terms of those incentives. But those tend to be traditional films. As time progresses, there will be more and more of the non-traditional ones that are coming here. And there have been a bunch already, some that take advantage of the incentives and some that just come here because we have a good crew base and they can work, you know, for less money and easier. But eventually our dream, as Lenny was just saying, is to have a New Mexico-based film economy where people from the state are making projects that have this, you know, much wider distribution. And they don't have to be about New Mexico, although that's, you know, would be best if it were, but the fact that they're just made in New Mexico.
To what extent are people coming from Los Angeles versus other places?
Well, L.A. is still the place where the industry is and where all the financing comes from. There have been some I think there was one project that came from Canada, and there's some rumors about some others coming from there, because Canada built up in the past 10 years, built up a pretty significant film industry that for a variety of reasons has declined. They're trying to put a blast on to revamp themselves, so we need to be careful in New Mexico about how well we do this kind of thing. And Lenny and I talk about this all the time. We have to, as a state, we have to be very attuned to servicing the outside world, because the more incentives that are created in other states, you know, that stuff will just go where the money is.
So people follow New Mexico's model in, say, Arizona, and then the same people who might come to New Mexico aren't coming here.
Exactly. The one thing that New Mexico has that no other state can replicate right now is a loan program for two reasons. One, when Gary Johnson was the governor, some folks may remember, he didn't approve any legislation to spend any money. So there's a huge surplus that was available when Governor Richardson got in. And then on top of that, we've had a really decent run of oil and gas revenues. And then the third issue is that is in the state constitution, it is permitted that the state can loan money under certain circumstances. No other state has that provision, and very few other states have anything like a monetary surplus. So they can, other states can have, you know, tax rebates up to 50%, which is an incentive for a lot of pictures, but no other state can have a loan program. And the loans are up to $15 million, and you can make a picture with none of your own money.
Now, are these loans, do they have a pretty good rate of being paid back?
We're in the process now of finding that out. The first pictures, the loan provision is that the company doesn't have to start paying back the loan until 5 years after a picture is released.
So it's too soon to know.
So we're right in that cusp of The Missing and a couple of others of that age group, which are approaching that point now. Number two, to get a loan, a production has to have a guarantor, which means like a co-signer, so that if – it's like a Lloyd's of London deal. If you as the production company default, then the state's not going to wind up with no money, but your insurance company basically picks up the pieces. And then the third issue in that is that some of the – actually one that we know of, Wildfire, which is a TV series, not a movie, that's been shooting down in Rio Rancho. They have already – they're ahead of the game. They have already paid back their first year, and they're about halfway – my understanding is about halfway through paying their second year's loan. So they're – you know, we range everywhere from we haven't gotten there yet to outfits that are already paying stuff back and that they're they don't need to yet.
We're talking to Barton Bond and Lenny Sanchez from the Santa Fe Community College and New Mexico's burgeoning film industry. One of the characteristics of the film industry, whether it be in New Mexico or anywhere else, is that people like you, Lenny, who are working crew, I mean, it's either feast or famine. Either you're working all day and all night for some period of time, or you have no work.
Well, what I do is I always try to keep busy. One of the things I do is I call around. I tell people that I'm around for work. I can work this day or I can't. But one of the things I do is I swing a hammer. And I'm on the construction crew with IOTC. So I'm a sound man for the smaller shows and, you know, the smaller shows. But other than that, I'm a construction guy, and I swing a hammer all day with all the grunts, and I love them to death.
So when some particular film is over, are you saying you're still working?
Well, I try and keep busy, but one of the things you need is you need rest. You know, we'll build a show and we'll strike it, and our bodies just, you know, we ache for days. And a lot of the guys that I work with, they and including myself, we need that, you know, 20 days off.
It's so different from the 9-to-5 bureaucratic schedule where you know where your paycheck's coming from each time. That's regular work. It takes a certain kind of personality to do this,
and it takes a, you know, a certain like mind frame, because a lot of the work, it's high pressures. These bosses are from Cali, and I tell the guys to keep it Cali a lot, because we need to you know, get this show done, and we need to do it in a time frame, and we need to be professional. And that's part of New Mexico guys. I mean, working in New Mexico, nobody knows how to do it better than New Mexico, you know, New Mexico carpenters, New Mexico technicians, because we know what it's like to work here.
Why is that? And what's specific to New Mexico that somebody from somewhere else might not know?
Well, they come here. They're not prepared for the weather. You know, it changes on a dime. We're outside. We get wind. We get cold. We get heat. It's
so
all
you're
combined.
Saying we're yeah. tough.
We're tough. And we know what comes up. You know, we know that it's not going to be a nice day later on at 5. We know it's going to get windy at noon. We know the kind of lunch we need, that we want to pack. And like I say, a lot of the guys that complain are a lot of the guys that come from Cali, because they're just not used to this kind of weather.
Let's talk to Barton Bond about the future of digital cinema. I mean, we've been in this sort of transition time for some while now between film and digital.
Well, the consensus that I believe has been out there for quite some time, Mary Charlotte, is that the film industry is moving, and has been for quite some time, away from traditional film, which is to say, you know, it's celluloid with chemistry on it. And there are a number of reasons for that, not the least of which is the expense of shooting on film and then having to have it processed and then brought back in some fashion to the shooting set so the director can see what they have and then the editing process, et cetera. So that process has been going on for some time. But the real breakthrough has happened within the past about a year and a half, and that is in the very tail end where the consumers are, called exhibition. The theater owners, for a long time, I'm sure your listeners have this vision that there are really three types of theaters in the country: those that are individually owned, like in New Mexico, there are maybe like a couple or three of those anymore. The Jean Cocteau was in Santa Fe, and you know, is no more. So there are these one screen things, and then there's the cineplexes, the small ones like four or five screens, and then the mega cinemas, which we now have the first one here. As time has progressed, it's become less, attractive for people to go to we call it the walk-in, because it's expensive, $10-$15 now a ticket, and the whole thing about the popcorn and the Cokes, and then you have to sit through two or three, four or five commercials after paying that amount of money. So you combine that with Netflix and the fact that very soon everybody will be able to download a serious movie off of the internet and be able to watch it on the big screen. It's really harmed the walk-in cinemas.
Although I have to say, I don't have a huge big screen television set, and watching a movie on your TV is kind of like watching it through a piece of dirty glass.
Oh, sure. The effect, the experience of going to the walk-in is the one thing that those folks have still to as a leverage. And if you go to the new cinema that's built here in Santa Fe, it's wonderful. The sound system is just knock your socks off. It's stadium seating. There are no bad seats. The screen is huge, et cetera, et cetera. But it's still really expensive. So the next iteration of film exhibition is going to be a much higher level of quality to attract people to the theaters, and also 3D, three-dimensional showings, which are, some of us old enough to remember the blue and the red glasses and all that kind of stuff. That technology has been surpassed incredibly by the newest iterations of 3D, which can be – there's some technologies that can be applied, Mary Charlotte, to any motion picture.
So they can scare the pants off you even more than they're doing now, basically.
Well, it's not just – the older 3D movies, A Creature from the Black Lagoon and like that, they really were, the things would jump out of the screen at you. But it's really different – a whole different experience to see we call a regular movie. Star Wars, for example, I've seen a couple of – from the very first Star Wars scenes that have been transformed into 3D, and it just – it's striking. I mean, and the next iteration of all this is going to be the directors and cinematographers have to figure out how to take advantage of that technology to help the story along. So presently,
and that it's always that moment of transition where you're using the technology for its own sake,
exactly,
rather than in the service of the art.
Yeah, and I think we're past now the gee whiz aspect of it, although there will be a lot of that still to come. But the next iteration of the digital cinema technology is really going to focus on the content. And because of the savings, the money savings, and how the technology is used, it will cost less and less over time to make many more very complex pictures. So that's also a factor in Hollywood. And a $100 million picture is nothing in Hollywood anymore. So they're talking $200 and $300 million pictures. That's an incredible amount of money. So for that money to come back to the investors, if a $200 million picture doesn't open number one and stay that way in the box office for a month, a lot of money's been lost. So at the other end of the spectrum, where we're going to benefit from all this stuff in New Mexico is that the cameras and the editing process makes it much more viable for smaller pictures to come to the state to take advantage of the incentives we have here to shoot in the environment that we've got for less money with smaller crews. So that aspect of – I mean, it's not just really neat that on a worldwide scale, but it's really going to have an impact on us in the state.
We've talked about this before on this show, but I think it's worth reiterating. Mm-hmm. To what extent, realistically, can you use this burgeoning film industry as the basis of New Mexico, or one of the main bases of New Mexico's economy, up there with tourism and other things?
Well, you will see right now, within the past 6 months and heading out the next 6 months, Mary Charlotte, a number of permanent businesses locating in the state focused on the film industry. In Albuquerque, of course, the Q Studios out in Mesa del Sol will be the largest set of sound stages in the country, larger even than the biggest ones in California, and certainly the largest, the biggest complex between the West Coast and the East Coast. And from that company, or from the entity building the buildings there, there are three or four companies. Sony Pictures International Animation Division has an office there now. NBC Studios and their Grip and Electric department has an outfit there. So we see a lot of spin-off already, even though New Mexico's film industry is fairly new. And at the other end of the spectrum, so that's what's coming from Hollywood, seeing New Mexico as a place where infrastructure can be built and money can be made. There are some serious discussions which have been presented to the county commission from an entity that wants to build a pretty serious studio at the county business park, which is across from the penitentiary, which would be a major boon to Santa Fe's economy and the ability to build stuff. Lenny and I talk all the time about trying to find ways to either get facilities or adapt them to make them to make the city more viable. I'm involved in a project which every once in a while shows up in the papers to convince the city of Santa Fe to let us convert the old Tina Griego pool at the Llano Street Library into a film shooting location, to use part of the pool to shoot underwater. It's called a shooting tank, and then the rest of it to be a place where we can do scene construction and some training. And it's not a be-all and an end-all. I mean, that's not going to make or break us, but if you combine that with the College of Santa Fe Garson Studios, which are just right there, and they're about to build some stuff out and this project in the business park.
For commercial use?
Absolutely, absolutely.
At the Garson.
Yeah. Every possible combination of a teaching facility and a rental facility, and working the two together. So it's not a killer yet, but the movie industry has brought in about, in the past 5 years, about $600 million to the state in total impact money. And it's clean. They don't burn anything other than the vehicles that are going back and forth. It's money from out of state, which is really, as opposed to the casinos. I don't want to get started on that one, but, that's mostly New Mexico money. And it has the potential to be something really tremendous. The state educational institutions, all the four-year schools and the bulk of the two-year schools have some kind of programs in media and film. Every high school has, in the whole state, I'm sure, has some kind of a class or either in film or media production, or classes use film and media. So we are a very literate state. The two major laboratories, plus White Sands Missile Range, do a lot of things at the high end of media that will have a relationship into the classes that we do and the kind of business we can attract here. So New Mexico is in a really wonderful status as opposed to many other states which don't have that level of whatever is going on. Plus we have and Lenny was a product of taking the training and now he's helping me instruct. We have the only union authorized film crew training program in the whole country.
Speaking of film crew training, there's classes coming up.
We have another session starting the first week in July. We go for 6 months at a WAC. The first 3 months of that period of time is an orientation toward the film industry, and the second 3 months is doing productions, which is what we're doing now from the spring semester. And for those of folks who are interested, we have a free orientation session about the film crew program on the 30th of May. There'll be plenty of ads in the local newspapers about that, so if people want to just keep their eyes open for that. And we talk about not only the program itself, but Mary Charlotte, you were talking about the lifestyle, which is a very big deal, and Lenny comes in to talk about that as well. As a survivor, basically, of it can be done, but it's not easy.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being here. Barton Bond is film video coordinator, business and professional studies department at the Santa Fe Community College. Lenny Sanchez is also with this community college, and he's a film crew member of the union. And we are delighted to have you here. Barton, what is a phone number or email where people can find out more?
My phone number is 428-1320. My email is bbond@sfccnm.edu.
We're going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. So there's all these missing emails at the White House that they claim have just disappeared. Don't ask me how, but the other day, they showed up in my email box. Here's one from September 12, 2006, to Harriet Myers, chief counsel to the president. "My tooth is hurting me. Let's fire 9 federal prosecutors today." Signed, Karl Rove. "Dear Karl, legally, we need a better reason to fire federal prosecutors. Now, if your back went out. Dear Harriet, it just went out. I'm emailing the president now." "Okay, Karl, but don't use big words like prosecutorial. It gives him a headache." Here's an email, September 13th, to the head of the Justice Department, Alberto Gonzalez. "Hey, Al, Karl's back is out. Fire 9 federal prosecutors pronto." Signed, Georgie. Email from Alberto Gonzalez to his chief of staff. "I have a busy day today. I'm signing the wiretapping bill, the torture bill, the who cares about habeas corpus bill. So if you get a chance, pick out the names of 9 federal prosecutors and fire them." Chief of staff to Alberto Gonzalez. "Will do, sir. But what reason should I give for firing them?" "How about poor posture?" "Only kidding. A little Justice Department joke. Find 9 who prosecuted Republicans and get their attaché cases out of here." March 13, 2007. Email from the president to Alberto Gonzalez. "Good job stonewalling Congress today. Did Karl give you that I don't recall routine? I'm going to work on that sucker for my impeachment hearings. I don't recall invading Iraq. I don't recall Katrina. And I certainly don't recall ever being president. Oh, yeah. And I'll talk to you next week, if you have a minute."
I'd like to welcome Judy Richardson. She's the founder and president of the Global Education Fund. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
The Global Education Fund is an interesting organization that is based in doing work in Nicaragua. Tell us about this group.
The Global Education Fund teaches trainers of other teachers in math, science, and language arts. We work with the Ministry of Education. We work with non-governmental organizations with the idea of teaching math, science, and language arts with a focus on thinking skills.
And so it's interesting. You're not training classroom teachers. You're training the people who teach classroom teachers.
Yes. That's the way to spread the network.
And so when you say thinking skills, what do you mean?
Well, we help teachers understand how they can get their students involved in their own learning. Traditionally, in the developing world, certainly in Nicaragua, education has been taught by facts, rote memorization. Our goal is to get teachers to understand how they can get their kids to start thinking and having fun with learning and questioning.
So why Nicaragua?
Well, it fell in my lap. I'm one of those fortunate people that have gotten to know Nicaragua very well. It came through a friend who introduced me to a friend in Nicaragua over 18 years ago. And I went there. I was working in New York, went there for a week, fell in love with the country, quit my job, put my things in storage, bought a car, and drove to Nicaragua. And I've been working there ever since.
You drove from here to Nicaragua?
Yes, in a caravan. It was a wonderful experience.
And so it is a very poor country. It's the second poorest in the Western Hemisphere after Haiti. What does that mean for the schools?
Well, the school situation in Nicaragua is very sad. Teachers make maybe $100 a month, even with a recent raise. It's a very poor situation. There are very, very few books in the schools. In the poor and rural areas, they really hardly have any books or supplies. So teacher training is really difficult. They do have some teacher training. Ours is quite unique, and that's why it's been so popular, because we really focus on how the teachers can help their students, not just simply on rote and memorization.
When did you first start doing it? How long has this been in place?
Well, I've been working in Nicaragua for almost 18 years now. And about 7 years ago started this foundation after I worked in Oklahoma City at the Oklahoma School of Science and Mathematics. I simply lifted one of their summer programs for rural teachers in Oklahoma and took it to Nicaragua, worked with the Minister of Education at the time, and he helped me see how we could funnel it into the projects in Nicaragua, the education projects, and boom, it grew. It's been very, very well received by the teachers.
What were some of the characteristics of that project specifically?
Well, the things that made it different than traditional training in Nicaragua is, one, we brought teachers into Managua, the capital, for one full week. They stayed together. Teachers and trainers, but mostly trainers. They had never been to Managua. So this was a whole new experience for them. They had never met teachers from around the country, ever. They don't get very far from their own little center of the universe. So this was one thing that was different. We work all day long at either math, science, or language arts. They go to their specific subject. They work hard, and at night we have cultural events for them. There's a marvelous theater in Nicaragua. We take them to the theater. They've never been to the theater, and some of them even teach theater. So we take them to the theater. We have the poets of Nicaragua come in and share poetry ideas with them. A friend of mine in Nicaragua told me one time that everyone in Nicaragua is a poet until they prove themselves otherwise. Everyone recites poetry. Rubén Darío is the national hero and an internationally known poet.
And isn't that amazing? I'm always marvel at countries where a poet is the country's hero.
Yeah, it's wonderful, and it's the culture of Nicaragua is beautiful. The music is fabulous. We bring the noted musicians in, Carlos Mejia Godoy and his brother Luis Mejia Godoy. Others come in. Sergio Ramirez is a famous Nicaraguan author. He comes in and talks, and they talk to the teachers about how they can keep the Nicaraguan culture alive and how they can utilize these elements in their teaching. We also bring in educational programs. We have a wonderful doctor there who comes in and talks to them about children they might have in their classroom who aren't learning, and a lot of it could be because they can't hear. So she talks to them about how to identify those kids and what to do with them. Bring them to me, she says. Call me. We'll figure out how to get them into Managua. Call me. We want to work with them. We work with one of the leading scientists there, and he comes in and talks, shows videos and talks about the destruction of the environment and how these individual teachers and their students can make a difference.
So where do you get the teachers who go down to train the trainers?
Well, the same ones have gone for the last 6 years, except in science. We have had a turnover in science. In fact, Santa Fe teacher who's going down with us this year from Monte del Sol School, Paige Prescott. But the others have been with me for 6 years. They are actually not classroom teachers. One of them is. The others are trainers, and that's our focus, training. So we do more than just teach how a teacher would teach a child. We really concentrate on how they train.
Well, what does that mean, a trainer who's not a classroom teacher?
Well, they talk to the teachers about how they utilize the classroom itself, how they can bring the resources of traditional good quality education into their classroom, teaching for understanding, constructivism, all the other elements that really make for good education. And we use a combination of those theories. We don't have our own theory. We don't even try to pretend that we do. We just simply show these teachers good teaching techniques, and they model classroom activities right there with their class.
What are some of the classroom activities that young people can do, that teachers can bring to these kids, given that they have so little money to buy equipment?
Well, they have, no money. Some of them do get some donations, which is nice. Well, for instance, in science last year, the science teacher asked me to buy 2 pounds of worms. So we went out into the countryside and found 2 pounds of worms and brought them in, and that's what they used. They used lights and
So you went digging in the dirt.
Well, hardly. But I do have some good contacts in Nicaragua. They knew where to find the indigenous worms. But they showed them how you can have a light under a worm and you can really see the structure of the worm. From there, they talked about how important worms are and what they can do. So that's one example. Newspapers are used a lot. It's the one reading material that most teachers, they can get donations from local areas.
Yesterday's paper.
Exactly. It doesn't matter if it's recent. They use pictures to They can cut out a picture and create a story around it. They can take a few words and create a poem around a few words. There's just so many things you can do with newspapers.
Education, it's almost a cliche. People say education is the way out of poverty. And to some extent that's true. And to some extent you have, I mean, I've met in Santa Fe people who are from Mexico. They went through their free education, got a great education. They're whatever, political scientists or chemists, and they come to the United States. They're washing dishes or doing construction.
Right. Well, it's true. I mean, in Nicaragua, you have very well-educated people, as many places in the world, who can't get a job because the resources aren't there. The jobs simply aren't there. However, our focus is on thinking skills, being creative in how you can think through ideas and problems. So there may not be a job there for you, but if you learn to use your own intuitive instincts and think rather than just learn by rote memorization, you're a step up than you were before.
That's interesting. I mean, intuitive instincts is one thing, but thinking skills, analytical skills, logical skills
right.
is another. I mean, that seems like that's what you're trying to do.
It is. That's exactly what we're trying to do because it's just simply not prevalent. Everything from when someone will do a job, they just do that job and don't think, what are the next steps along the way? So we work on that. How do you think through things? How do you use disciplines interdisciplinarily, is that a word, so that math and science work together, math and language arts work together?
Now, have you seen the effect of this so far in the years that you've been doing it? Have you been back, seen the classrooms, talked to the students?
I've talked to the teachers that have been trained, and I've talked to some of the students when I visit into the classrooms, and they're doing these wonderful projects. It's so much fun. Here's one example. We teach the normal school teachers down there. The normal schools are the schools that, like our normal schools used to be, they train teachers. So then I went back to one of the normal schools, talked to the science teacher one time. And he said, well, here's how your training helped me. And he said, in science, I've always shown students how to make soap. It's one of the experiments we do. Now, after having the Global Education Fund training, the students do the experiment. They make the soap. Before that, they go to the library and they research soap making. They put research into it, and they document each step along the way. That's creative, logical process thinking. So just in that one classroom, those kids are learning process thinking that they weren't getting before. Now, the normal schools have support from Luxembourg, so they do have good laboratories. But then when those students leave there to go train, to teach out in the rural areas, they have nothing. So by helping these teachers, specifically at the normal schools, we can help them help their teachers train in conditions unlike the normal schools.
So when these young people are living in a rural area, they graduate from school, what happens next? What's the vision?
Well, most of the students that are going to be affected by our program and our training probably won't even graduate from high school. We'll be fortunate if they get through primary school. That's why we teach practical application of academics. How can you, like worms, how do you really use science and use it apply it to your daily life? There are few high schools in Nicaragua. Once you graduate, there's schools around that you can get to, primary schools, but to go to a high school, you have to travel a distance, and not all children can do that. So not many of them go on into high school. There's a huge dropout right after primary school.
And so the effect of the work, is it mostly you're trying to reach young people, elementary school age?
Right now. At one time, we did train some secondary school teachers, but now our program is pretty much focused on primary and multi-grade. In the rural areas particularly, a teacher might have several different grade levels going on. Even adults sometimes come to the classrooms in one classroom. So we do multi-grade. And we also we've trained teachers who have had no more than a sixth grade education because they happen to be the one in their area that has any kind of an education. So we have had a huge variety, which makes our training very interesting, from this, you know, these people who have a sixth grade education to educators who have graduated from college.
Judy Richardson, the Global Education Fund is having a benefit coming up. Tell us about the whens and wheres.
It will be Thursday, May the 24th at 6:30 at Cloud Cliff. And we invite anyone who's interested in learning more about education in Nicaragua, about Nicaragua itself, to please come. We have a video now that was produced by Geraldine McCumber, a Santa Fean who was down last year with us at the program. It's a beautiful video. It's wonderful. It shows Nicaragua, daily life in Nicaragua. It's a lovely video, and it tells a nice story about our program. So we invite people to come. There will be a cash bar for wine, a few hors d'oeuvres, and a lot of good information.
And there's no admission charge per se.
Right. There's
people can do what they want.
Exactly. There's no admission charge. If you're so moved, we could always use a donation. We always need help. We have a small budget and no salaries. Everything goes right to the projects in Nicaragua.
Is there a telephone number and or website that people can consult?
Yes, there is a website. It's globaleducationfund.us. If there's anyone out there that wants to help with the website, it's definitely needed, as you'll see if you go to it. The phone number here in Santa Fe is 982-2426.
Judy Richardson is founder and president of the Global Education Fund. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Appreciate this.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.